Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. For years, there were rumors that filmmaker Henry Jaglom had taped hours of his conversations with Orson Welles, but that the tapes had been lost. They weren't. Now the transcripts have been released in a new book, edited and introduced by Peter Biskin. Welles regularly met his friend and business partner Henry Jaglom for lunch in L.A. to discuss future projects, old anecdotes, and Hollywood gossip. Jaglom kept a tape recorder running in his bag, which Welles apparently requested to accumulate material for an autobiography. Now in a book transcribed and edited by Easy Rider's Raging Bulls author Peter Biskin, these long-rumored conversations are in print. The new book is My Lunches with Orson, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Peter Biskin to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Always nice to have you aboard. What brought you to this project? How did this fall into your lap?
Well, I ran into Jaglom initially when I was researching the book you mentioned, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, in the early 90s, I guess. And Jaglom had come to Hollywood in 1965, approximately, and had fallen in with the BBS crowd, BBS being the company that produced Easy Riders, The Last Picture Show, and Five Easy Pieces. And that included Jack Nicholson and a lot of the sort of hipper, Dennis Hopper, a lot of the more hipper elements in Hollywood. And he kept a diary of those years, which was, he shared with me, at least partially, and which was very interesting. And during the course of our conversations, he told me that he had these, had recorded these tapes of his lunches with Orson Welles. At that time, I was busy writing that book and subsequently other books, and but I always had in the back of my mind what happened to these tapes and might they be turned into a book. After my last book, which was a biography of Warren Beatty, I was sort of sitting around with nothing to do and looking for another book to do. And I asked Jaglom about the tapes, and he had never played them, and he had never revisited these conversations, and he had been busy making movies. So I persuaded him to have them transcribed, and I read them to see whether there was enough material in them for a book. I mean, there were lunch conversations, and lunch conversations can be rambling and interrupted by visitors and ordering food and so forth. So I was a little skeptical that, in fact, they would work, but indeed there were amazing nuggets in these conversations, and Welles turned out to be a rather extraordinary person.
Talk a little bit about the rumors around the tapes themselves, because they were believed to be lost. They didn't know if they existed, but Jaglom knew that all along, that he had them, right?
Yeah, Jaglom knew they were there. He just forgot. I mean, he sort of forgot about them, but he had many offers to actually turn the tapes into books, but he turned them all down. It happened that he was a fan of my Warren Beatty book. He knew Beatty and thought I had done a good job capturing him and so forth. So he was very open to letting me do it, and that's the way it happened.
These conversations take place in the 1980s, early 1980s. Where was Orson Welles in his career? It was a few years before his death.
It was, they took place in 83, 84, 85. Welles was in the declining years of his career. In some sense, his movie career was over. But he was still writing scripts. He had a number of partially finished films that he was trying to finish. He was writing original scripts, and he had other projects in various. People would come to him with projects that involved him, like there was one based on the Cradle of Rock, which was a play he put on in the 30s that was closed down by the government. So people, there were all kinds of different sorts of projects that he had, and he was also doing commercials in those days, just trying to make a living, get enough money to live on.
But he was very, it seemed in the book anyway, that he was very aware of his cultural place at that time.
He was. I mean, he was acutely aware of his own importance, let's say, and his myth. he would say, I mean, there's one incident in the book where Richard Burton comes to his table and says, I'd like to introduce, Elizabeth would like to meet you, meaning Elizabeth Taylor. And Wells just sort of brushes him off and says, can't you see I'm eating? And Burton sort of slinks off. Subsequently, Jaglom sort of kicks Wells under the table and then berates him for being so rude. And Wells says something to the effect of, he has to do the dancing bear act. That's what people expect of him. They expect a bigger-than-life, blustery, arrogant personality, and he acted that out in many, many instances.
When it comes to Jaglom and his questions, this was all under an agreement between the two that this could perhaps be an autobiography?
Yeah, Wells, you know, envisioned the time where he would no longer be able to direct. I mean, he was already approaching it. He couldn't get any of his projects off the ground. And physically, he was deteriorating. He was extremely overweight, and his knees were not in good shape, and directing is a physically exhausting activity. So he imagined that when he couldn't direct, he would write his autobiography with Jaglom's help, and he wanted to use these tapes as notes.
So with that, Jaglom then becomes not only a filmmaker, but becomes an interviewer, but he's still a filmmaker. So it's interesting in the questions that he asks and the questions that would be different if, say, you were to have lunch with Orson Welles.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, Welles sort of vicariously directed through Jaglom. Jaglom asked his advice on various movies he was making, and Welles was very free with his advice, very willing to give his advice. Would go into the editing room and look at the scenes on the moviola, and give Jaglom very specific and helpful advice. And you know, I think what's unique about this book is that they were friends. Jaglom performed each one benefited from the relationship. Jaglom was performing a service for Welles, namely trying to raise money for him, the same way he raised money for his own films by selling off European territories, which was what the independent filmmakers did in the late 80s and 90s. Jaglom was a little bit ahead of his time and thought he could raise money for Welles in that fashion. He also served as Welles' kind of gatekeeper, informal agent, and manager. And in turn, Jaglom, I think, enjoyed being the gatekeeper, enjoyed the reflected glow from Orson Welles, who was, after all, Citizen Kane was considered the best film of all time, best American film of all time.
So for listeners who are hearing this story and perhaps not fully aware of the power of Orson Welles, but wondering of how someone like Orson Welles, who was responsible for Citizen Kane, could come to a point in his career where he was persona non grata in Hollywood, seems very hard to believe.
Well, Welles is a classic case of somebody who peaked too early. You know, he had a very, very successful theater career before he even started in film. He was on the cover of Time magazine at the age of 23. He did Citizen Kane at the age of 25, and he was given Final Cut by RKO, the studio that produced it, which was extremely unusual in Hollywood and also very unpopular among the other studios. He would never give directors Final Cut in those days. After Citizen Kane did not do well, partly because it was William Randolph Hearst, who was widely seen as the prototype of Foster Kane, who was the film was about, pressured the other studios who had those days owned the exhibition chains not to show the movie. So the movie was confined to independent theaters, which hurt its grosses. Also, Hearst owned, you know, a slew of newspapers and refused to take advertising for the film in any of his newspapers. So the film didn't do well. Consequently, RKO, which had given Welles a Final Cut on a two-picture deal, reneged on it, renegotiated it, and the second film in that deal, which was Magnificent Ambersons, Welles did not have Final Cut, and through a kind of perfect storm of poor circumstances, namely World War II broke out. Jacqueline was sent by President Roosevelt to on a goodwill tour of Brazil. He lost control of the movie. The movie wasn't finished when he left, and it was edited in Hollywood. Wells expected the rough cut to be sent to him for his approval and for him to turn into a fine cut, but that never happened because of the war. It was impossible to send the footage down. And then they previewed the film in some town in the San Fernando Valley that was, you know, where the audience was accustomed to Esther Williams films. And the audience jeered and laughed at key places, and the studio took the film away from Wells and recut it. Thereafter, there were many, many films that either Wells lost, you know, that were recut by studios, or Wells, for one reason or another, couldn't finish. So he gained the reputation as somebody who walked away from his movie. He was blamed for it. He gained the reputation of somebody who walked away from his movies, got bored in the middle of them, and didn't finish them. And that is a kiss of death in terms of raising money for future projects.
So what were his great successes? What did he consider his great successes to be?
Well, he made a cycle of three Shakespeare films, Macbeth, Othello, and a film called Chimes of Midnight, which was an amalgam of Falstaff material from several of the different history plays. The weird thing about it is that parts of all his films are exceptional, and parts of them were, you know, ruined by the studios. In some cases, they were misconceived by Wells himself. But I think that, you know, he considered Touch of Evil a really good movie, and I have to agree with that. He made it towards the end of his career. I think the last feature he made was a so-called essay film, a film that sort of falls midway between documentary and fiction, called F for Fake, which was a kind of meditation on authenticity in art and fakery. And it was made around the time that Clifford Irving fabricated a fake biography of Howard Hughes. And it also has to do with a famous art forger. And that film is really interesting, but it was dumped by the distributor and nobody's ever seen it. And Wells always felt that had the film done well in America, he would have done more of those kinds of movies because they didn't require, you know, big budgets. But it didn't do well and he never made any more. I think, you know, Lady from Shanghai certainly has its fans. You know, I would say the Shakespeare films, those two films, and parts of Magnificent Ambersons.
Peter Biskind is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book, My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles, edited and with an introduction by Peter Biskind. When you consider the tenor of these conversations, there is a sentimentality that kind of runs through them.
Yes, I think that's probably true, but I think what's unique about them is that, as you alluded to earlier, Jaglom was a fellow filmmaker and a friend of Wells, so he didn't approach these as interviews. You know, they were conversations, I wouldn't say exactly between equals, because, you know, it was, in fact, Orson Welles, and who was his equal? But they were friends, and Wells let his hair down. In other words, he felt free to gossip about his friends and make, you know, lots and lots of critical and negative remarks about them, people he knew. He felt free to be completely politically incorrect and tell all kinds of off-color jokes, sexist jokes, homophobic jokes, racist jokes. Down deep, he was none of those things, which I think is also interesting. He was a very, in many ways, a very generous person, but he was bitter. He was bitter that what had happened to his own career, and he was envious of his peers like John Huston, who succeeded in operating in Hollywood and negotiating the Hollywood maze where he wasn't.
And he had many, many ideas. I mean, much of what he's talking about are ideas that he has for for future films, and I guess ultimately looking for that one last triumph.
He wanted to make King Lear. He was desperate to make King Lear. And he wanted to make a film about Spain, which he had shot part of. He wanted to do this Cradle Will Rock. He had a film that was caught up in the French courts called The Other Side of the Wind. And then he had another original screenplay called The Big Brass Ring, which was about contemporary politics, which is an extremely interesting screenplay. And he almost got that produced. Jaglom managed to find a producer, Arnon Milchan, who pledged $8 million if Jaglom could get Wells could attach any one of six or seven A-list stars at that time, people who were A-list stars at that time, including Warren Beatty, Jack Nicholson, Clint Eastwood, Robert Redford, and so on. And for one reason or another, they all turned it down and it never got produced.
There are some wonderful cameos in this book where, as you mentioned, Richard Burton, but like Jack Lemmon will stop at the table.
Jack Lemmon stopped at the table. Many, many people. One of the funnier ones is Vincent Minnelli's wife stopped at the table. Vincent Minnelli was in the hospital and was quite ill. She stopped at the table and treated Orson as if he were Minnelli's best friend and said, Vincente would be, so happy if you would call or you would come by the house. He would love to see you and so forth and so on. And she said, where can I reach you? When would be the best time to call you? And when she finally left the table, turned to Jaglom and said, I never met Vincent Minnelli. I don't know him. And, that sort of thing was going on all the time.
How bitter do you think he was?
He was bitter. There's no question about it. I mean, you can see in the conversations, the way he trashes people and how angry he is. But at the same time, I think partly, I think he blamed himself, that I think he recognized that in some sense he had been his own worst enemy. I mean, it's interesting when you read these or listen to these tapes, you see that he always had excuses for not going ahead. I mean, it's a funny combination of circumstance and character. As I said, a perfect storm of unfortunate circumstances and character flaws, I think, that in some sense just crippled him.
What was your reaction the first time listening to them of that? Because it would seem to me that you would have that sense of eavesdropping in on a conversation.
Well, I did. I was skeptical to begin with. I was not a Wells scholar. I'd seen, of course, seen all his movies. But I'd never been, I was impressed by Citizen Kane, but I'd never become a devotee of Wells. And I didn't know that much about him. So I'm reading these transcripts. And as I said, a lot of it was just, had to be discarded. But, I quickly realized how brilliant he was. He had opinions about everything. He had an enormous breadth of knowledge. It's not just movies. It's politics and theater, dance, music, classical music, books, all sorts of literature. He was an omnivorous reader. And he had extremely original opinions about everything. So every time he would come out with some nutty idea and Jaglom would challenge him, Wells would never back down, but in defense come up with a really interesting, sort of crazy, but fascinating rationale for whatever it was he was defending. For example, he attacks certain people like Betty Davis on the basis of her physical appearance. He said, I just didn't like the way she looked. I could never stand to see her on the screen. And Jaglom said something like, well, how can you judge her based on the way she looks? And he said, that's perfectly legitimate. There are ethnic and racial characteristics that, everybody feels this way, but nobody will say it, but I will. So he claimed that, for example, Sardinians had thick necks or Bosnians had stubby fingers. And he would go on and on that way. And after a while, you started to half believe him.
there was a great intelligence there, certainly on display in these conversations. And one of the things that I found fascinating was, and you alluded to this a moment ago, but how culturally aware he was. For a man at the end of his life and at the end of his career and an older man, to be that aware of what was happening on the greater cultural landscape, I thought was fairly impressive.
Well, he followed everything. You know, he was, I mentioned that he was very interested in politics. He twice considered running for Senate, once from his home state of Wisconsin, one from California. And Alan Cranston, who eventually became a senator from California, discouraged him and said, you'd win Northern California, but you'd never win L.A., Southern California. And then Cranston went, and Welles never ran, and Cranston went on and ran and won. And Welles said he always considered that his seat. He was good friends with Franklin Roosevelt. He knew Winston Churchill. He hated Ronald Reagan. He had lots to say about Nixon and Kissinger. And he had lots of interesting things to say about World War II and the French Resistance. He published a he created a newsletter, apparently, that went to the French Resistance, and he knew a lot about them. And he had very interesting things to say about people who collaborated with the Nazis, like especially entertainers like Maurice Chevalier. And he talks about how he changes his opinions about them over the course of the war, that he came to feel that who was he to be so critical of people who were in life and death situations, who he himself, living in Hollywood, and lolling by his swimming pool, he'd never been in that situation, and he shouldn't, he should get off his high horse. That's essentially what he said, but in a much more intelligent way than I paraphrased it.
What are the challenges for you in editing a book as opposed to writing one?
Well, it's a whole lot easier, I'll tell you that. And, it took a lot less time than I'm used to spending on books. But it does take some work, and you have to know what to keep and what to put in and what to take out. And the book is organized roughly chronologically, but as conversations go, the two of them would come back to the same subject in different lunches, sometimes separated by months. So I took in most instances, I took everything, say, about Charlie Chaplin that sometimes occurred months or years apart and put them in one place. So I reorganized it. It's in rough chronological, but not strictly chronological order. And the other big challenge was that condition of the tapes was not great. I mean, the quality of the tapes was terrible. As you mentioned earlier, the tape recorder was in a bag, and then beyond that, they were taping in a restaurant, so there's lots of background noise. And even in the best of circumstances, conversations are hard to record accurately. So trying to make sense out of them, was in some instances very tough. Some parts of them were very clear, and there's no issue. But so I would say organizing them, figuring out what to keep and what to discard, and making sense out of some of them that were a little bit garbled were the most difficult things to do.
Was Jaglom a resource in that?
Not as much as I would have liked, because these tapes were like 30 years old and he couldn't really remember the conversation. So when he read the rough cut of the book, he was sort of amazed. But I should say the other part of editing it was finding a character arc in the book as if it were a novel. And what I tried to do was show Welles as more hopeful in the beginning of the book, 1983, and as he gets progressively disappointed by people who have pledged money and all they want to do is have lunch or dinner with him, but actually when push came to shove, they reneged, he gets more and more bitter and more disappointed and more and more depressed, so that at the end he has a wonderful speech about how the reputation of not only filmmakers but writers and artists are so evanescent. And he says one day he'll be totally forgotten. It'll be as if a trap door will open up under him and he'll just be swallowed up.
The name of the book is My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jagalom and Orson Welles. It is edited and with an introduction by Peter Biskind. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. It's a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.